This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is being brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used to manage personal injury, medical malpractice, MDL, class action law firms all over the United States. Great program, highly recommend it. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. Today's episode is being brought to you by Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the place to go for everything involving experts to help you win your case. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. And today's episode is being brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a one-stop shop for all of your digital marketing needs. Check them out at hypelegal.com.
Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
I'm Ben Gideon. So Rahul, you're in Vegas today. What's going on in Las Vegas?
Vegas, the weather is really nice. I actually had a trial that was supposed to start on April 15th. And this is kind of the life of us trial lawyers, Ben. It got kicked to July 8th in the 11th hour on Thursday of last week. So now I'm just gearing up for three trials that I've got set coming up over here. What's going on over there?
Enjoying a beautiful day here in Maine. The weather's picked up. It's quite nice and very busy. My partner, I don't know if you saw, he just tried a case.
Got a good verdict.
Weeks ago, got a nice verdict. So we're excited about that. Maybe I'll have him on to talk about it. And just plowing away as we always do.
What's with the heart in the background?
That's from the symbol that a lot of the businesses in Lewiston put up after our mass shooting in October of 2023. So as you know, we represent about 90 families that were victims of that mass shooting. So we're pretty tied into that community now. And that heart is just there to symbolize that connection. So on that note, we're very pleased to welcome Paul Miller to the podcast. We're officially going international, Rahul. We have our first international guest. Paul is a trial lawyer from Toronto in the great country of Canada. So before we jump into the world of trial law, I know you're a big golfer, so I promised that I was going to quiz you on your take on the Masters this past weekend and what's going on in the world of golf, because I confess that my golf knowledge is pretty limited and I don't understand the current slate of top players.
The first thing you have to understand when you live in Canada, watching the Masters is the beginning of spring, because there is nothing green in Canada yet. So to watch the Masters for 4 days, see sunshine, flowers, and green, that's the reason I watch primarily, because it gives you a feeling of hope. That's number one. The golf world is a mess. This live crap, it's a joke when you hear guys taking $600 million. You did it for the money. Just say you did it for the money. What's wrong with that? But the Tiger effect, everyone's looking for the next Tiger, and he's generational. It's like looking for the next Michael Jordan. LeBron is not Michael Jordan. Scottie Scheffler's not Tiger Woods. And love Scottie Scheffler, his game, but he does not have a charisma of Tiger Woods. People aren't going to flip on the TV channel to see Scottie Scheffler play. He doesn't have that cachet yet, and nor do I think he will ever. And that's okay. Great golfer. But golf is a mess right now, and there's just too much money being thrown around with LIV and the Saudis, and I think it's just annoyed a lot of people.
This is great. I mean, I feel like everyone got their money's worth from this podcast already. We could just wind it down right now. That was terrific. We're in the wrong business, Rahul.
I put some thought into it. Yeah.
I mean, that was one of the better takes I've heard. And you did that just on the spot, impromptu. This is why you're such a great lawyer, I'm sure. Rahul, are you a golfer?
I mean, you know, it's interesting that Paul said it. I'd say that the only reason I ever got interested in golf is because of Tiger Woods. I consider myself an absolutely terrible golfer, but I really enjoy playing whenever I can. I haven't really been following too much. One of the players actually went to the high school my kids go to, La Cañada, Colin Murakawa. And so all the kids in town follow him, of course. But I'm not fully understanding what the big deal is about LIV and the PGA. It sounds like some master play to acquire the PGA, and it was well played. But what makes it annoying?
I mean, just paying guys to play very few tournaments, three rounds, shotgun starts. It's like playing at your member tournament at your home club. Like, there's no excitement to it. And you're trying to create something. There was already something there, and no one cares about these teams. John Rahm and Bryson wearing their team hats. I guarantee you that no one's running out to buy the Crusher team hat. And I think I find it very bothersome that it's Saudi-based. Like, I really do. It turns my stomach. I find it somewhat offensive that these guys are running to the money. It's not like these guys are starving on the PGA Tour. They had generational money in any event. I guess the question is, how much is enough?
Well, we should probably move on to the topic of practice of law, but you're very outspoken for Canadians. We typically think of Canadians as very gentle and nice folks that aren't super aggressive. But so I think that's a nice segue to...
Well, I work with a lot of U.S. lawyers, and I think it just through osmosis I've become like
that. So in terms of that, because you're our first Canadian guest, can you just kind of give us a survey of the landscape of what being a trial lawyer in Canada is like? And I know you're very tied into a lot of the U.S. litigation too, particularly mass torts. So what are the similarities and what are the differences? And if for people that are listeners that may be looking to cross those boundaries, what do they need to know?
The one thing that I learned when I first started doing the mass tort work is whatever is sold in the United States almost is always sold in Canada. So whatever is defective in the United States, it's defective here too. So that's number one. I mean, we have the same pharmaceuticals, same medical devices. So there are a lot of similarities. And all the companies are up here. The biggest difference that you see is we're common law based, and you bring your cases in a specific province. We do not have a federal system set up for like the multi-district litigation. That is a huge difference where you're then trying to coordinate cases throughout the country in various provinces. The biggest difference, though, is in the damages. Non-pecuniary damages are capped in Canada, and it goes back to 1978. The Supreme Court decided in a quadriplegic case that the general damages, non-pecuniaries, should be capped at $100,000, but cost of living would be applied every year to that. So right now, that cap, in 78, it was 100. It's now about 470,000. So we're happy about that, but it's terrible when you have to explain to a client that the most you're going to ever get for pain and suffering is $470,000. There's no caps on loss of income, future care, things like that. We also have very poor law in terms of punitive damages. It's virtually non-existent, which is a shame. We just finished off a case with a U.S. counsel against Boeing. We had a client who was on the Ethiopian Airlines case. It was a Boeing MAX 737-8. The case would have been worth $500,000 in Canada. That's it. This was a 24-year-old female, not married, mom and dad, brother, sister. It was worth $500,000. I can't tell you the exact amount, but it was a ridiculous amount of money if you think of it in Canadian terms. Okay. And, you know, Boeing probably paid what they did because of what Boeing's going through right now. Where in Canada, you would never get a court to punish Boeing the same way a court potentially could punish Boeing in the United States. So that is a major difference. So the evaluation of cases, it has to be really particular. And because you're not going to see runaway verdicts here, you're not going to be able to get 8-9 figures verdicts in Canada. So that's the biggest difference. But otherwise, we see a lot of overlap in terms of evidentiary rules are very similar, experts, things like that. So working with U.S. counsel is always very helpful to me because I don't have to invent the wheel. When I go into a mass tort, I partner up quite often with Motley Rice, work in arrangement, and I've got them providing me their science, their experts. So that makes it more feasible for us than trying to start from scratch and building a model to win a case like that. In Ontario, we have juries for civil cases, but essentially everywhere else in Canada, there's no juries. I can tell you that in the case, so my firm does a lot of single event catastrophic personal injury. Juries are not well liked by the plaintiff's bar in Canada. The defendants want the juries. So it's completely opposite. And one of the biggest differences is that, first of all, we have very limited voir dire. We get to know the person's name, where they live, the type of job they had. We might be able to ask the judge if we can get a further explanation of the type of work the person did. That's about it. And then after a trial, we're not permitted to speak to the jury in any way about their decision, which is really hard to stomach when you get a really bad decision. But again, plaintiffs really do not like the jury system right now.
Does it need to be unanimous?
Yes, for a civil case. Probably for a criminal case, yes. I think it's 12 jurors in a criminal case and it has to be unanimous.
And can you just share a little bit about yourself? How did you become a lawyer and get into the focus of doing plaintiff's cases and kind of mass tort cases work that you do?
It was a roundabout way of getting into law. I wanted to be in journalism. And then my mother said, no, you're not going to be a journalist. You're going to be a lawyer. So I decided, okay, I better go to law school. And I want to be a hockey agent. So I did that for about 5 years.
Like every young Canadian who isn't good enough to play hockey.
That's right. You either go into sports casting or a hockey agent. And I did it for 5 years. I did a couple NHL contracts for guys who would bounce up and down between the minor leagues and the NHL. And then I realized I started hating the game because it was a business. Like I just lost my love and I just said, I can't do this. Back in the 90s when I was getting involved with it, 20% of the agents controlled 80% of the salary. So sort of did the math. I was like, well, if I can't get with somebody, it's going to be really tough. So I did it for 5 years. And driving through the winters of Ontario to small towns, you know, an hour or two from Toronto and then back at 12 o'clock at night was not my idea of fun any longer. So I decided I better get a real law job. And I ended up as in-house counsel for 3 months at some corporation. I hated it. And I then found a job in personal injury. Never wanted to do personal injury, but it was the job. And then I sort of just developed over time and got involved with U.S. counsel in 9/11 cases. And then it sort of just grew from there. I have, you know, what my partners described as a very non-traditional personal injury practice, which makes it fun for me.
How is it non-traditional?
So my firm, again, does mostly single event PI work, and I don't do any of that. So I'm usually involved with major aviation cases, opioids now. We act for 2,300 veterans for a drug that the Canadian military administered between 1992 and 2017. So it's non-traditional in that the mass tort model has never been used in Canada until I started using it in 2011 in the transvaginal mesh litigation, because all these cases used to be able to be brought as class actions. So what would happen is you'd have multiple firms starting class actions, and either you had to make a deal to get to work with them, or you had to go to court and have the court pick a law firm. It's called a carriage motion. And that, I hated that. Not that I didn't think I could win a carriage motion, but the idea of going and bashing your colleagues just turned my stomach. So I figured instead of going into the class action world, let's try and model something after the MDL. And in transvaginal mesh, we had about 250 cases. And it worked really well because I worked with U.S. counsel. We were able to get really good settlements. And it gave our clients the right to make a decision if they wanted to settle. Whereas in a class, they really had no choices. So that's how it became sort of non-traditional. And I tend to get these different off-the-wall cases rather than my partners. And they tolerate me because it does make it a very interesting practice on a daily basis.
Which is a nice segue to one of the cases that we were interested in, wanted to talk to you.
I set you up for that.
I know. Perfect. Perfect. So probably many of our listeners, myself included, have read about and seen news accounts about this condition called Havana syndrome, which seems like a very mysterious thing that apparently affects diplomats and who've served posts overseas in different areas named after some folks who got sick, I guess, in Havana, Cuba. But I learned that you're involved in representing folks related to Havana syndrome and interested if you can tell us more about that. What's going on with that?
Sure. So in 2018, we got retained by a total of, well, now we have, I think, 18, 19 clients. The original cohort was 10, I think. Those were the original people that were hit in Havana. So we started litigation against the Canadian government because the information that we got from clients is that the Canadian government knew what was going on before the first attacks on Canadians and did nothing to protect them, did nothing to advise them. And, you know, the Canadian government has an obligation to make it safe. These postings were also company posts, meaning that the diplomats had their families because it wasn't considered a very dangerous posting. So now we have spouses who are ill. We have seven or eight kids who were young. Like, we had kids as young as six and eight that got hit, and they're alive, and they have documented mild traumatic brain injuries based on neuropsych exams and other testing.
And what are the constellation of typical symptoms for Havana syndrome?
You start hearing a high-pitched noise, grinding sound, and you don't know what's going on, and you get dizzy, you get headaches, bloody noses, throwing up. And sometimes we've had some people get better right away, but we have this cohort of people who have had lasting symptoms. And one of the major issues is hearing loss and tinnitus. We have two clients who have documented holes in the bones in the auditory canal, which a couple of Americans have as well. This condition is known as Myhre's syndrome. It happens in like less than 1% of the population. How could 5 or 6 people in one area around the same time all have the same condition? You know, statistically, it doesn't make any sense. So we sued the Canadian government, and they have done everything in their power to delay. They are finally producing documents to us, and we're starting to find some patterns of what the Canadian government's goal was down in Cuba with the embassy. Because you need to realize the Canadian relationship with Cuba has been very different than the U.S. You know, the U.S. pulled out their embassy when Castro came in. Canada has always had diplomatic relations with Cuba. It goes back to Pierre Elliott Trudeau, and always had the embassy open. And then this has been a problem because part of our theory is that the prime minister does not want to destroy the relationship with Cuba. For whatever reason, maybe it's to protect his dad legacy. I don't know, but it has been an issue of why Canada is so cozy with Cuba and not as cozy with the United States on this issue.
We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno, national court reporting service that allows trial lawyers to defer the costs of court reporting until the end of the case. Take a look, steno.com. And by Law Pods. Law Pods is the podcast production company that we use to produce the show that produces podcasts for lawyers all over the country. They have an expertise in podcasting and the law. Check them out at lawpods.com.
Are all of your clients folks that were posted in Cuba, or are there other embassies that were affected as well?
So all of our clients were posted in Cuba. We are now getting information through a source that there were Canadians hit along with Americans in other locations around the world, as recently as 2021 in Vienna, Austria. And that had to do with the expulsion of a Russian diplomat. It appears that one or two Americans and one or two Canadians were targeted after the expulsion of a Russian diplomat. We don't have any clients who suffered anything in China or England or some of the other places where Americans have been hit. I know that I've spoken with John Bolton on two occasions, and he detailed how his people, when he was the director of the NSA, were hit in London, England on Trump's trip to visit the Queen. And one or two of his staff members were hit right outside the White House. So it's close to home for him, and he wants to see something done.
What is the current theory as to what the nature of these attacks was? Was it microwaves, some other lasers or something?
It's still unknown exactly whether it was microwave or sound waves of some sort. It recently was revealed in a 60 Minutes episode who they believe is behind it. It is the equivalent to the American CIA, is the GRU in Russia. And there was a subset in the GRU called, it was a group called 29155. And they are tasked with assassinations and disrupting life for people. And that is their goal. The device has been worked on for years and years, going back into the 90s, we believe. And again, because we don't know for sure what it is, we have a pretty good idea. And it's something that can be handheld. It doesn't need to be put on a truck. It's something that can be hidden almost. From what we've heard is that when Russia wants to test something, they need a laboratory. Their laboratory is Havana, Cuba. Because of their relationship with Cuba, they can go in, they have free rein, and the Cuban government can give them intelligence on where people are. So Russia wanted to apparently test a device to see if something could do silent assassinations. Now, no one's been assassinated, but it is silent. And whether this technology, there are rumors that this technology was developed by countries involved with the Five Eyes, which is the United States, Canada, Britain, New Zealand, Australia, and that it might have fallen into the hands of Russia, or they developed a similar weapon, and that this has to be kept quiet. You know, so more and more is starting to come out as the investigation goes on by these folks at 60 Minutes and The Insider. A journalist by the name of Christo Grozev was the key person.
Are there parallel cases going on in the United States?
So there's a lawyer in Washington named Mark Zaid, who does a lot of national security litigation. He is acting for a number of U.S., but they can't sue the U.S. government. So they are trying to do other things, work with Congress and the Senate to get people paid. There was a passage of a legislation that got victims who could prove that they were victimized. I think it was $186,000. You've got people from the CIA, the FBI, NSA, who aren't working any longer. So we have been working with Mark Zaid for the last 5 years. We're getting more and more U.S. cooperation going forward. Plus, some of our clients were seen by U.S. doctors immediately after they were hit. There's a doctor down in Miami by the name of Michael Hoffer. I believe he's former Navy, and he investigated or examined a number of Americans immediately after their hit in Cuba, as well as four of our clients. And our clients were also sent to the University of Pennsylvania, who came out with the first study. And during the testing, the Canadian government stopped all Canadian diplomats from being involved at the University of Pennsylvania. The only thing we know right now is that they cited national security reasons. We can't get the medical records of what was done there. It's very frustrating. We're not sure why it's national security to know what happened to our clients.
So we talked about this before we started recording, but would there be a viable theory potentially against the Russian government, since it sounds like they're behind this? And could those cases be sued in the United States or in Canada?
Never looked at it. Probably not, because there would be immunity, state immunity for the government, because unless you could show it was a terrorist act. Was it a terrorist act? No one has said that, you know, so I don't think we could sue Russia. How are you going to collect from Russia?
You could take possession of a yacht or two, maybe.
Right, right. But I think we feel better going after the Canadian government and their obligations to the Canadians rather than trying to get into international litigation with these guys.
So how far along are you in this case?
How far along? The government just delivered a tranche of documents. We are trying to set up what you would refer to as depositions starting in July. And I'm sure they are going to do everything in their power to avoid producing the people we want. We want the ambassador for one reason. In April of 2017, the first client that was hit, a Canadian who was first hit, lived next door to an American diplomat from Texas. And on April 10th, they went for a walk because it's known that their homes are bugged. So they go for a walk, and American details to my client exactly what happened, the sound, the resulting effect, and that it's happened to other Americans. So on April 11th, my client goes to, and he's living in Cuba with his wife and two kids. He goes to the ambassador, he meets with the ambassador and two or three others. He tells them exactly what he was told. And the ambassador says, you are not to tell anybody. what you just told us, including your family or any other diplomat. The Canadian government does nothing until late May to discuss this issue with others from the Canadian government. And in June of 2017, this gentleman and his family are targeted and hit. A source, former CIA agent who has become a source of mine, said to me, your first two clients that were hit purposely because of what their positions are. I don't have national security clearance, so I do not know what their quote-unquote positions were. But my guess was they weren't there on a trade mission. So the fact that the Canadian government knew as far back as probably prior to April 10th, 2017, and took no steps to warn the diplomats and the family members of what was at risk, to me, it's just a huge failure on their part. And they need to compensate these people. That's it. And they are doing everything they can to delay, delay, delay.
Are these attacks still ongoing?
The most recent attacks that on Canadians was 2021. The person that I spoke with last week said they believe some attacks happened as recently as last year. There was talk that when Kamala Harris, I think she was in Vietnam on a diplomatic trip, there were attacks there. I mean, Christopher Wray, the director of the FBI, said about a week ago, this is a very real problem we have to deal with and help these people out. That's the first time he's come out and said anything like that. And I believe on May 7th, the Homeland Security, there will be congressional hearings with Homeland Security on Havana Syndrome. So he's gaining some momentum right now.
And is there any known antidote or defense to these attacks?
No, that's the problem. The subsequent diplomats were told that if you believe you're being attacked, get out of your house. All of these attacks happened either in hotel rooms or in their homes, never in the embassies or anything like that. So they said, get out, get outside, because there's just the sound, I guess, echoes, it bounces off walls. And they just say, get out. There's no known treatment for it. There's a lot of people in the scientific world that don't believe it. That's number one. They have said mass hysteria as one of the explanations. And I mean, which was insulting to every diplomat, because these are trained people. You know, they're in Cuba. They're not in the middle of Afghanistan. Okay, maybe people are panicking and suffering from PTSD. There was a theory that it was pesticides. We immediately said, how come the pesticides only harmed certain Americans and Canadians and not every other country that has an embassy in Cuba? So that was debunked pretty quickly. One of the theories behind the concept of coming up with different ideas is, you have to understand, if this was Russia targeting Americans and Canadians, that under, I believe, the Geneva Convention is considered an act of war. So if you have an act of war, what is a country going to do? They're supposed to respond. And at the time, Canada is never going to do anything on their own. We're chicken shit. So if you don't have the United States taking the lead in fighting Russia, we're not going to take that lead. So we'll see if things are going to change. Those congressional hearings will be very interesting. And, you know, there are a number of prominent Americans now, John Bolton, Charlie Kupperman, who was his deputy, that are getting more and more involved to help out the diplomats who are injured in the U.S.
It's fascinating stuff. I mean, we'll be following it along. It's an important thing you're doing to represent these folks and to try to find some justice for them and to get them answers. You know, it's probably a case that very few lawyers would wade into.
Yeah, I don't really think many wanted to wade into this because, one, you know, there is some risk in terms of our federal government. You know, there is no doubt that we believe people are listening into our phones more than they used to and monitoring our emails or text messages. So that's a little bit disconcerting when you're just a stupid lawyer trying to make a difference for some people. But it's a situation where something bad happened. And one of the problems is that if our government or any government doesn't protect their people, how do you go and try and get new people? Because right now, if I'm someone considering going into the diplomatic corps and I know this is going on, that my own government is not going to protect me, why would I even want to take that risk?
the thought occurred to me that if someone offered me a post as an ambassador to Vietnam, for example, I might think twice about accepting that. Although, just if anybody's out there listening and interested in appointing me to that, I'd probably still consider it. I'd like to live at the Metropole Hotel in Hanoi and enjoy the chocolate buffet every afternoon, but it does come with risks now and a hefty price. And I worry about you now, Paul, because in the one podcast, you've offended and alienated the Saudis, the Russians, the Canadians, and, you know, but you'll be okay.
And it's not even 10 o'clock.
I know. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing this story. And we will follow it with great interest. And I hope you'll come back and share the outcome of it.
Anytime. Thanks so much.
Thanks for joining us, Paul.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.